Access number 4427, Reel 2.
Brigadier McNab, Reel 2. Did the troops who were taken up to the northern frontier area, the KR troops that were taken up there, ever have a system of taking women from amongst the Turkana up there as temporary wives?
Well, in my case, I didn't serve in Lokitang, but in Karamoja, when C Company went up there, they went up there with their wives, and they walked the whole way from Kitgum to Kakamari. Some of the wives that they took with them were concubines who they'd already got their own wives being at home still looking after their shambas and that sort of thing, you see. I think fellows did take concubines when they were established at Kakamari. If they hadn't got a wife, they found one who was a concubine. And if he got fond of her and she was a good concubine, he took her back to Bombo eventually when he went back to headquarters again. There was one case, for instance, of an effendi who married her, who took a concubine. He cleaned her up and turned her into somebody who looked like a newbie. She plaited her hair and all that. But the Karamojong women, they were covered in cow's fat, and when they wanted to wash, they got near a cow, and they washed themselves in cow's urine, and they stank to high heaven. And they couldn't have them like that, you see. And we more or less said that they had to be reasonably all right. So, but this effendi, he took this very beautiful Karamojong girl and turned her into a newbie. And she was outwardly a newbie woman. But she asked if she could go on leave. He took her back to Bombo, and she was accepted as a newbie woman. And she came to me for a pass to go down to where her manetta was. And a helio message arrived from this effendi, saying, could I see what's happened to his wife, because he wanted her back. She had 3 months' leave, and she'd overstayed it. And I sent off some men to find her, and they brought her back, and there she was, back again, with all the awful straggly hair and the bangles round her neck and all the rest of it, stinking to high heaven. And she utterly refused to go back, although she had wonderful clothes, and she started off back to her manetta as a, well, civilized sort of person, but she reverted back.
What does manetta mean?
Manetta is a stockade where they live all together in huts with a boma, a ring round.
A thorn fence?
Yes, and all the cattle get moved in there at night with them.
Can you tell me what uniform your KR troops used to wear?
They wore shorts and a bush shirt and blue puttees, bare feet, red tarbush, not a webbing belt in those days. It was a leather belt. And they had leather pouches. You had their field service stuff, you had straps with pouches, the old-fashioned sort of Lewis gun pouches, but made of leather as opposed to webbing.
And what about their weaponry? Was it the same
they
as
had the
303, British
infantry? They had a 303 and they had a Lewis gun. And we had one machine gun platoon, but no mortars in those days.
Did British troops have mortars in those days?
Didn't have any British troops, there weren't any.
No, but would infantry in Britain have had mortars?
No. The 3-inch mortar didn't come in till 1930, 5.
So their weaponry was the same as for a British infantry unit, was it?
Yes, I think it was. Yes.
What about supporting services like RAMC, RASC? Was
none,
there anything of that
none,
kind?
None at all when I arrived. That came in with the brigade system. They started the what they call the S&T, Supply and Transport, which his headquarters was in Nairobi. And they had Thornycroft lorries. But when C Company moved up to Karamoja, they walked. They went by steamer to Kachung. I can't remember the name of the lake now. Oh dear. Anyway, they went by steamer from Port Bell up north, and then they went Lake Choga. That's right, Lake Choga to Kachung. Then they walked from there with their wives. And in fact, babies on the way. I mean, say the sergeant major or somebody would come along the line of march and say, "Please, Effendi, the wife of so and so is about to produce." So you left a section or a few men behind, went on, and they caught you up in the process of the next 2 days.
And how did they cope with a newborn babe?
Well, that was carried on the woman's back.
What happened as far as medical attention was concerned? What did
well,
you do?
When we got to Kakamari, which was the company headquarters, we had what was called a sub-assistant surgeon, who was an Indian. And that was the only medical attention we had at all. And the nearest doctor was at Kitgum, which, if it was raining, well, he just couldn't get there. In fact, when I was on the Piri Patrol, I got rheumatic fever. I didn't know it was rheumatic fever. And I was carried in a blanket strung to a pole 35 miles back to Kakamari, and they couldn't helio because there were clouds. That was our only form of communication. And so I was either going to die or I was going to get well. And the doctor couldn't get to me because of the black cotton soil. So that was that.
Why should... You mean the black cotton soil was...
prevented the lorry from coming up.
And how efficient was the sub-assistant surgeon? What could he do?
I think he... I don't remember him ever doing any operations or anything like that. He administered the normal sort of... a chap had constipation, that sort of thing, you know. But we had a little sort of hospital with a few beds and that sort of thing. But people were remarkably fit. And it never occurred to one that one would have appendicitis or a toothache or anything like that. My happiest time was leaving the Kakamari and the headquarters and going off to Piri, which was about 32 miles away, on the edge of the escarpment overlooking Turkana. And one used to average about 200 miles a month on one's flat feet, going from waterhole to waterhole, and some of the waterholes were 28 miles apart. And one prided oneself on these marches. And looking back, one shouldn't have been priding oneself. One should have been proud of these wretched porters who were carrying 50-pound loads on their heads. But it was a very ponderous patrol business because, unlike the Sudan Defense Force, who we used to meet periodically, our radius was much greater than theirs, but we moved at a much slower pace because of porters carrying food for porters and so on, you see. And then we had our meat on hoof in case you didn't meet any animals to shoot. And so it was a sort of pretty slow-moving affair. And we kept down a certain amount of the cattle raiding, into tribal cattle raiding and so on, and elephant poaching, merely because they knew that we were on patrol, but they didn't know in which direction the patrol was going, you see. And so it did make them watch their step a bit. But we never caught up with them. If they had pulled off a good cattle raid, we could never catch them. Whereas the Sudan Defense Force, they carried enough food for 8 days, i.e. 4 days out, 4 days back. But in our case, we carried enough food for a whole month.
And which tribes were doing the cattle raiding?
Well, the Turkana would raid the northern Karamojong, the Dadoth, and the Turkana were raided by the Tapothans, who were in the Sudan.
And how did you recruit the Porters?
The DC did that. He was down in a place called Moroto, which was 70 miles away from Kakamari. And he would send up 130 porters every month. And they were reported at Kakamari and sorted out. And the ones that would be the Piri Patrol ones and the ones who would stay in Kakamari. But we had about 100 porters a month, 130 porters a month.
Did you pay them yourself, or did they get paid by the DC when they got back?
They didn't get any money. They got food, meat and maize meal.
So they were paid in kind, really. Mm. Mm. Why do you say that the Piri Patrol was your happiest time?
Well, one felt king of all one surveyed. The Kadepo Valley, which is now one of the world's most famous game reserves. I was the only chap, only white man, who ever went into it at that particular time. There wasn't another one for miles and miles and miles. And I used to patrol into the Sudan, go around the Megillah Range and Zingoti and all there, and I suppose I was... I was not in touch with anybody. And one just had to rely on these excellent black men to find one's way about, to all the rest of it. And it was a feeling, after all, I was very young. I was about 25. And you felt frightfully important.
I think that you said that you relied heavily on the Wanderoba.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the job they did, why you had to rely on them so much?
Well, some of the water holes were a bit dicey. And although they should hold water, they didn't always. If it had been a particularly dry year, and you couldn't very well send a scout 28 miles and come back again to say, yes, there's water there. So we had the chances there was water there. And then the Wanderobo came into their own, because if there wasn't water at their particular waterhole, they jolly well knew where to dig in the riverbeds to find water. Because it was their country. And they were wonderful trackers. They had really the instincts of, or the ability, of a lot of wild animals. They really were awfully, awfully near nature. And one relied on them heavily. And one's platoon sergeant always used to say to them, you know, what about it? There's no water here. What about where's the next place, sort of thing.
So these were Wanderoba trackers whom you used?
Well, they were porters, too. But, of course, one relieved them of loads as early as possible because they weren't as physically fit as the others.
Were the Wanderobo ever recruited into the KAR?
Not that I know of, no. No.
Why was that?
Well, they hadn't got the physique for a start. And they didn't, they weren't that sort of, they weren't martial men in that sort of way at all. And they were very primitive indeed, very primitive.
Which were the tribes who were most suitable then for recruitment, apart from the
Well, apart from the newbies, the Acholi, I think, probably were the best in Uganda. The Acholi. Whereas in Kenya, the Acholi were Nilotic. And then you had the Baganda. The Baganda had more brains than the Acholi, and you generally found that they were the signalers, that sort of thing. But in Kenya, we went more for the cattle tribes, the Hamitic Nilotic people, the Kipsigis and the Nandi. And then also the Wakamba, who were a Bantu and first cousins of the Kikuyu. But the Kikuyu didn't enlist in the KAR.
Why was that?
Well, they didn't see any point in it. They didn't sort of like the idea.
Was it the discipline they didn't
I
want?
I don't know. They did come in the war, in the 39 war, but generally as drivers and things like that, not as infantrymen.
What was your estimate of the Africans in the KAR as troops? How did they compare with British troops?
Well, from the point of view of physical endurance and ability to withstand tremendous variations in climate and so on, they were superior, undoubtedly. I mean, an African would think nothing of a 28-mile march carrying full equipment. And indeed, in the war, mortars, all the paraphernalia of battle on his shoulders, which the Gurkha could probably do, but not the British soldier, no. And, of course, another thing was the tremendous happy natures, laughter. They had a great knockabout sense of humor, and somebody else's discomfiture was, of course, enormous laughter. there were things like the monsoon campaign in Burma. I don't think that any other troops other than the Gurkhas could put a candle to us from a physical endurance point of view. But, of course, they were not good at holding ground and withstanding enormous casualties. That wasn't on. As long as everything was going all right and you were going forwards in the attack and so on, it was all right. But you were a little bit fussed whether your sword wouldn't bend in your hand if there were a tremendous lot of casualties. But they were awfully good in this way, that battle inoculation, they really did understand and profit by it, much more so than the British soldier. And before we went into Burma, we gave them a terrific battle inoculation. We fired 25-pounders over their heads 200 yards in front of them and all that sort of thing. And then when we got into Chittagong, before we went into Burma, we stuck them in the bamboo forest and we jittered them up every night, pretended we were Japs, banged bamboos and said, "We come to kill you, black man," and all this sort of thing, you see, and fired off. And it paid off enormously. It was the fear of the unknown that made them run.
What about the handling of the troops? Were they easier to handle than British troops or not?
I think that one tended to treat them in a much more paternalistic way than one would treat British troops, simply because they were unsophisticated. And you had to cater for their unsophistication by understanding them. And once they'd got confidence in you, well, they were in many ways very easy to handle, except for the things like the fear of the unknown. And this we tried to get over with battle inoculation, which I think proved very successful. But they're not like the Aberdeenshire, Bampshire ploughboy who says, here I am, I've dug this hole and I'll stand in here for the last man. They didn't want to sell their lives in that sort of way at all. But we also learnt various things like airdrops. For instance, the brigade I had in Verver, we were on air supply for 3 months solid, K rations. But luckily for us, in Madagascar, some troops had been sent by a ship from Mombasa, destined for Diego Suarez. But because of the Japanese submarines, they had to go down to South Africa, and they didn't have African rations. They had British rations. So they had bacon and eggs for breakfast and enjoyed it thoroughly and all that. But when they got to Diego, they had to walk 25 miles to the Orange Peninsula. And only about a quarter of that battalion arrived at the end of the march. All the other ones were flaked out in ditches all the way along the road. And it was the most awful business. People were terribly ashamed about this, you see, because we'd always shown ourselves to be tremendous marchers. And it was discovered that they were suffering from malnutrition. Well, not malnutrition, but they hadn't had the bulk that they'd been used to. And so, from that moment on, we were warned in the air supply business in Burma, we had to have, once a week, a free drop of posho.
So it was like a carbohydrate.
Yeah. It was a jolly lucky thing that this shame-making thing happened in Madagascar. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known about it.
Were there not any special problems with African troops then, as far as discipline was concerned, that you might not have had with British troops? I mean, did you have problems with drunkenness or woman trouble or things like that?
Well, yes, you did have a bit of people going to bed with a comrade's wife when he was on patrol and that sort of thing, and that was not liked at all. And the punishment for that was heavy.
What punishment would you give?
Well, a fellow who went to bed with another fellow's wife, the only time that I ever had any dealings with it, it became an affair where the battalion was paraded in Hollow Square, and the chap was sentenced to 6 lashes, and he lay down on the ground and had a wet cloth put on his bottom, and the provost sergeant gave him 3 this side and then walked around 3 the other side, and then he had to stand up, pull up his trousers, stick on his hat and salute and fall in, and the whole battalion watched it.
What was the demeanour of the people who watched?
Oh, they not a flicker. They were all standing to attention. And it was the punishment fitted the crime. But of course, when the brigade system came in, it all had to stop. And, well, there we are. But it's certainly they understood it. And every chap that was beaten, and I only saw three beatings, it absolutely took it like a man. I mean, it was, there was no question of squealing or putting the can there and saying, ah, oh, you know, they were...
So they were on their mettle, in a way.
Yeah. Mm.
What would be the methods of training the African troops? What was it exactly the same as training troops?
Well, no, it was more reiterative. It was no good drawing things and no demonstration, explanation, interrogation, practice, which is what the British Army system. We couldn't quite do that. It was more showing, demonstration, practically the whole time. And then you'd pick up, for instance, the parts of a Lewis gun and all that sort of thing. You would have to do it. And then each bit you'd have to say its name, and then they'd say its name. And it was all very slow, rather like sort of kindergarten in a way. And... they were, once they'd got it, in fact, C Company, we didn't have, we had two third-class shots, 75% of the company were marksmen, and the rest were first-class shots. But if they went on leave, they went on leave for, say, 3 months because their homes were a long way away, the chap would come back and he would use one of the foresight protectors is the foresight, and you couldn't make out why he was missing the target, and then you suddenly realized that he'd just forgotten which was the foresight. They didn't hold it, not all of them.
Why were they such good marksmen? Because of their eyesight?
Frightfully good eyesight, yes. Frightfully good eyesight. In fact, we came to learn, latterly, that when you had mortar platoons, you had a British NCO with the mortar platoon. And the idea was that you put the British NCO as the observer, making the range right and all that sort of thing. And you had the African sergeant in the pit watching the bubble. But we turned it round the other way and put the Africans in the OP and the British rank, so that they didn't get too excited and forget to look at the bubbles.
So you were using the best qualities of each type for a specific job.
Mm.
When did British NCOs come in?
Well, when I arrived in 29, there was only the bandmaster and the RSM. And the RSM was always a colour sergeant, promoted RSM from the Brigade of Guards. And those were the only two NCOs in the battalion. Not NCOs, there was the bandmaster who wasn't, he was a warrant officer class one, I think, probably. And the RSM, there was the only two.
In West Africa, I think they had larger numbers of British NCOs. Did you feel that you could have done with more British NCOs in the KR?
In
those days?
No. No. Far rather not.
Why is that?
Well, they would have got in between you and your men, and the whole thing, it was... practically everything was based on the askari regarding his officers, his father and his mother. And if you'd put somebody in between in those days, I think you'd have spoilt it. Also, you had to have a very good caliber NCO, you see, because it was a tough sort of life that they would have been out of their element, I think. Really? I don't quite see what they would have done. Mind you, in battle, the sort of things that one had to do in Burma, you had to have them. But it was too big a drain on the British Army to produce the necessary caliber of chap. You had 32 British officers and 32 British other ranks in a battalion. Well, it was a tremendous drain on the British Army.
What was your daily routine in the KR?
Well, you started off the morning with PT, unless you were on patrol, naturally. And then you did your weapon training, individual training, and then you did your musketry classification, and you did drill, and you did a little bit of